What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Music Business Dreams podcast. This is episode 53, and I'm your host, Brandon, from KDMR Music. Now, full disclosure, I was not going to release this episode today. In fact, I was not going to release another podcast episode until November 1st, but I got this interview and I just couldn't hold on to it. Like, I couldn't keep it from you guys. So, I do want to let you know we won't be back after this until November 1st, but today is very special. So today I'm talking to Wendy Day. And some of you may know who she is, some of you may not, but in case you don't, I'll go ahead and read her bio for you. So Wendy Day started Rap Coalition in 1992 to be an advocate for artists who have little to no leverage in the music business. So after shopping and negotiating many favorable deals for artists and creating many millionaires in the music industry, Wendy has now gone on to consult and help build independent record labels while writing a series of how-to books and music resources to help artists excel. Now, again, if you don't know how big of a deal Wendy Day is, let's just listen to this next part. Wendy Day has worked with many artists, including Eminem, Tupac, Twista, Do or Die, David Banner, Slick Rick, Boosie, Webby, Fiend, C Murder, Trouble, Little Donald, and many more. She played a crucial role in shopping and negotiating the deals of Master P's No Limit, Cash Money, Eminem, Twista, David Banner, and many others. Wendy's clients have sold a combined over a billion records over her 27-year career. So right now, Wendy is building an educational website to teach artists about how to make money with music, and she just received the funding to start an incubator for independent rappers to help them start their own record labels. Wendy's based in Atlanta, and she's going to give you her contact information at the end of the show. But you can follow her on YouTube at youtube.com/thisiswendyday. Now, that was a mouthful. I've said a lot, and I could talk for another 30 minutes just about everything she's done in the past, but I will let Wendy speak for herself. So let's go ahead and bring the interview in. Guys, today we have with us Miss Wendy Day. I did read her bio earlier on, but I'm really excited about this conversation. So thank you so much, Wendy, for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here.
I really appreciate you agreeing to do this and having this conversation. So why don't we start with just a brief introduction for people who may not be as familiar with you. Why don't you introduce yourself to us?
Okay. My name is Wendy Day. I've been in the music industry for 27 years, but I've been a fan of rap music since 1980. Most of you weren't born yet. but I came to this as a fan. Like, I just really love the energy and the passion in the music. And in 1992, I started a not-for-profit organization called Rap Coalition. It was like my way of giving back to the years of happiness that rap music gave to me. Wow, that sounds really corny, but it's true. And I started the organization because there was no one in the music industry that was helping artists that weren't currently making money.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was kind of fucked up. Can I curse?
That's fine.
Good.
You're totally fine.
And I thought that was kind of fucked up that when artists were at their height and people could make a percentage, they were happy to jump on board. But when there was an artist that was like on a downturn in their career, I felt like everybody was abandoning them. And I had a problem with that. So I started Rap Coalition to help pull artists out of bad deals. And then around 1990, that was in 92. So around 94, 95-ish, I realized that just pulling somebody out of a bad deal wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. That really, if somebody was going to live their dream, I had to help get them, or somebody had to help get them into a good deal. And because I had seen so many bad deals, I felt like I was qualified to help somebody get into a good deal.
Gotcha.
And Master P was my first deal that I was part of. And then I went on from there to do a deal at Atlantic Records for Twista. I worked with Do or Die. I didn't negotiate their deal, but I helped put out their first single, Po Pimp. It was also the first single I ever worked on. And it was a great, single to work on because it went platinum.
Right.
And then I worked with David Banner, Eminem. I did the Cash Money deal at Universal. I'm probably most well known for that deal because it was such a big deal. But I've worked with Bootsy and Webby. I've worked with Trouble from Duct Tape. I've worked with Young Buck. I've worked with Little Donald. Little Donald is probably my most recent success. He had a huge song last year called Do Better.
Got you. So are you a lawyer by trade? Is that?
Oh God, no. Oh God, no. I can't stand to lose. So I never went to law school. No, but I'm making jokes, but I'm surrounded by a lot of attorneys. And I have an attorney with me for everything that I do. Like I don't negotiate a deal. I don't pull somebody out of a bad deal. I don't do anything without a lawyer, an entertainment lawyer on board.
Right.
Really, really, really important.
Got you. So how would you describe your role in that negotiation process?
Chief executive troublemaker, maybe. You know, I have this vision for artists. Like once they tell me what their goals are and we map out a plan to get them there, I feel almost a little bit like GPS. Like I figure out how to get them from A to Z. And then if there's some accidents or landmines in the way, I figure out a way around those or over those or under those. But getting to the end goal is always the goal, you know?
Right.
And when I'm negotiating a deal, I want to make sure that the artist has as much ownership and control as possible, because then they can really control their career. You know, sometimes when you sign to a label, a major label, especially when they hear the music, they'll say, well, gee, you know, Chop is hot right now, or DaBaby's hot right now. Can you make music more like them? And that's the kiss of death, to take somebody out of who they are and try to make them become somebody else. So if you've already got a lot of success doing you, then it's very easy to get a label on board because they see the success that you're having and they see the fan base that you're building, and they want to be part of that instead of having you join their company and try to shape you and mold you into something you may not be.
Got you. That's very true.
So that was a really long-winded answer, but that's the role that I play in a negotiation. The thing that I learned about helping with the Master P deal is, like, I was like one of five or six people. And that was hard for me because I remember when I suggested things that were a little bit outside of the box, that the team was like, huh, we can't get that. We can't ask for that. And my philosophy is you can always ask for it. It doesn't mean you'll get it, but at least try.
Right.
You at least try to get the best deal possible. I mean, you shouldn't be insane and ask for, you know, the letter M to be removed from the alphabet, but you can certainly ask for stuff that makes sense, like ownership of your masters if you have enough leverage, 100% ownership of your publishing, whether you have leverage or not. There's just certain things that I know you can get if you ask for. And then there's other things that are a little bit harder, but that doesn't mean you don't ask for them.
Got you. What's an example of one of those things that maybe the artist wanted, or maybe that you felt like was a good thing for the artist to ask for, that seemed really unlikely that you guys ended up getting?
Every time publishing. Every label that I've ever negotiated with has come out the gate saying they want to own 50% of the artist's publishing. And in every deal I've done, I have never, ever, ever had to give up publishing to a major label for the artist. If the artist chooses to go on later and sell a portion of their publishing, as much as I'm against that, I can't stop them. But we're not going to give up half of the publishing or any percentage of publishing just to get a record deal. That's insane.
Right. Now, for those who may be new or not familiar with those terms, so there's a difference between master royalties and then publishing royalties.
Yes, the
two. Could you explain that for them really quick?
Absolutely. Master rights are the actual ownership of what the recording is on. So if you're pressing up CDs, and I'm going to go old school for a minute, mm-hmm. only because this will make it really clear. If I'm pressing up CDs, the master rights are the rights to take my music and put it onto that CD.
Right.
The publishing is the ownership of the words and the music. Mm-hmm. So the master usage is the thing that allows you to reproduce the music. Mm-hmm. The publishing is the actual words and music.
Right. So traditionally, a record label's job is to press up the music and distribute it and get it out there.
Yes.
Right. So
yes.
That activity should not warrant them getting that publishing.
No, but in their minds, they feel like they're entitled to it because they're putting up the money.
Right.
And somewhere in life, money became more important than art. I'm not sure where and when that happened, because for me, the art is more important. And I can illustrate that best by saying, if I have a ton of money, let's say I have $2 million and I'm sitting at home, I can't make music. I can't rap. So all I have is money. I can market and promote myself, but I suck. Now, on the flip side, let's say I have no money, but I'm super talented. I can sit at home and I can put my music up onto a platform and people will listen to it. It probably won't go very far because I don't have money. Mm-hmm. But if I can get my music out there and start building a fan base, that tells me that the art has more value than the music.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, people want things that they can't have or do themselves.
Right.
Right. And that's right. What I tell, you know, the artists I consult with all the time. Like, I don't care how small your fan base is. When you go outside and you play your guitar, you're doing something that most people that are walking by can't do.
Can't do. Right.
And, you know, that's attractive to someone.
I agree.
So, you know, that's why we talk about so much about content marketing and putting yourself up on YouTube. It's like, no, you may not have a million subscribers, but there are people that are paying attention to you just because they don't get to see that every day.
Exactly. You
know, Kanye's not putting up beat making videos. If he did, I'm sure they'd get millions of views, but he's not. So you have that opportunity, you know?
And I think that's what attracts the major label. That's what attracts any record label. Mm-hmm. But in this context with the major labels, I kind of prefer them because there's no middleman. Mm-hmm. So if you're going right to Sony or right to Republic or right to Def Jam or right to Interscope, you're going right to the source, right? Mm-hmm. And what I like about that is if they're coming to you and they want to sign you, that shows you that your talent has value and you don't have to give up everything in order to sign a record deal, especially if you're already building a fan base on your own. If you're making money on your own, you have so much more leverage when a label comes, and they will. Mm-hmm. You have so much more leverage because you don't necessarily need them. You might want them, but you don't really need them.
Right.
And they know that.
Yeah.
So they have to be a little bit more aggressive in what they're willing to give you in terms of money, in terms of ownership. And I just feel like everybody should retain ownership of their publishing.
Yeah.
You should not give a piece of what you've made to somebody else just to get on. It doesn't make sense.
Right. Right. And I mean, a lot of times people end up regretting it, you know.
I'll bet almost every time. Because you're giving up something and you don't know what it means, but the labels have been doing this for decades and decades and decades, so they know what it means financially. They've been through this. When you're a new artist, you don't realize that you could make $1 million with your publishing in your first year if you're, you know, even just somewhat successful. You don't even have to be like, you know, have a hit record, and you can make a lot of money.
Gotcha. So, and that kind of leads into the conversation that I wanted us to have today. You know, it's been up and down on social media the last few weeks, right? First, Chance the Rapper went on The Breakfast Club and basically said, look, everyone should stay independent. You can hire someone to build the business around your music, but don't give it away.
Right. You know?
And then Frank Ocean last week was like, hey, there's a lot of independent rappers, and I think that's good. I think everyone should stay independent as much as they can. Right now, both of those figureheads are like this super inflated example of what it means to be independent.
Right. They hit the lottery. They're right. Very successful.
Right. And with Chance specifically, there's like this whole counter motion on the internet. Like, well, Chance isn't really independent. Chance has, I don't know, they keep moving the goalposts for Chance. I don't know why. But it's like, right. And so it's like, okay, well, what's independence? Is it owning your music? Is it owning your publishing? Is it not making a certain amount of money?
Like, it's actually judged like by professionals. It's judged by your masters. So if you own your masters independently, you're considered an independent record label. Okay. You could even go through a major label like Universal Distribution or Sony Distribution. As long as you own your masters, you're considered independent. Chance is independent.
Got you. So
Frank Ocean is independent.
He is. So with that said, how do you feel about the advice that seems to be kind of in a vacuum? That's just like, stay away from a record label at all costs and protect yourself.
You know, I love that you're asking this because it's such an important question. And first, let me state my bias up front. I am a huge fan of independence. I believe in it 1,000%. Having said that, it's not for everybody. You know, you can't say all people should do this or all people should do that. There are a lot of artists out here who are not entrepreneurial and they're not able to work their music independently. They don't have an investor. And this is a very, very, very expensive industry.
Yeah.
So I don't want to tell an artist that they shouldn't sign a deal when not signing a deal could mean their failure, you know?
Yeah.
So while I agree in theory with Frank and Chance, I do believe you should do this independently. If I were an artist today, I would go and find an investor. I would do a deal with that investor. I would get anywhere from $250,000 to $500,000 invested in me. And then I would hire somebody like myself that has done this before successfully, and I would have them show me how to do it, but I would learn as much as I could from them so that I could continue to do it on my own. And I would build my own company. I would bring in other talented artists, you know, to come through the pipeline after me, and I would build my own empire. But not everybody has the ability to discover talent or to run a company or to learn how to market and promote. You know, there are a lot of artists out here that really just need to be artists. They're great at it.
Yeah.
And they don't need to be running their own company.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that art and business kind of take up separate sides of your brain.
Yes.
I do believe that creative people can make great business people.
Yes.
If for no other reason than they're willing to try things that other people won't.
Yes. And to surround themselves with people to sort of help them, especially in the beginning, to develop that skill set. Because if you're an artist, you might be able to develop into a great businessman like Jay-Z.
Right.
Jay-Z was not always a great businessman. I've known him since day one. You know, okay, not day one, not since birth, but, you know, since he came into the music industry with Jazzo. And Jazzo was the business guy. Jay-Z didn't really have that ability early on, you know, and I don't want to, this is not disrespectful to him because he's really come a long way. But I remember when he hired people to be around him to deliver in the areas where he wasn't strong.
Right.
You know, and like he had Biggs and Dame in the very, very beginning. And then he had John Menealy, you know, to help him with the business side and grow the company. He had, is his name Jay Cooper? I always screw up his first name. I think it's Jay Cooper, to help him run the business. So he's always had people around him that were business savvy to help him develop into the entrepreneur that he is today. And today he makes great decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, quiet is kept. That's the mark of a real business person, right? Understanding where you're deficient and saying, all right, well, let me bring these people around to complete this picture.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I went to art school in the 80s and I realized that I was never going to be a great artist. I went to school for graphic design and I realized I was never going to be great at it. And I also realized that in having an art degree, that I didn't have enough sales and marketing experience. So I went and got an MBA in marketing and I learned how to do that. So if I can do it, you guys can do it. It's, you know, it's not saying that everybody should go get an MBA. That's not what I'm saying. But you've got to learn how to sell yourself and you've got to learn how to market and promote and get your music, you know, that's already great, not only to the next level of greatness, but to get it out there to the masses.
Right. Yeah. Cause I mean, at a certain point, it's not even necessarily about the greatness of your music. It's about how many people are aware of it.
Exactly. And like it.
Right.
Cause they can be aware of it and hate it and you're not going to succeed. But if they're aware of it and they like it, they'll support you and they vote for you with their dollars. It's, you know, it's the same thing as like running for office or running for president. You've got to get out there and promote both online and in real life.
Right.
You've got to do both. You've got to reach the people.
Absolutely. So for artists who are starting out, who don't necessarily know all the ins and outs of marketing, what are some advice that you have for them to either to learn or even things to just put into practice from the beginning?
You know, there's so many things online right now that are really great. Like, I just finished taking a YouTube course so that I could be better at developing my YouTube channel. And I took it through YouTube. There are companies that will teach you how to run Facebook ads and Google ads and, how to be better at social media. There's so many outlets and a lot of them are free. Like the YouTube course was free and I couldn't believe that it was free. I'm like, wow, this is like, you know, the most knowledge I've gotten in a long time. And I can't believe I didn't have to pay for it. Then on the flip side, there's a lot of, marketing people out here that have courses and give free advice. There's a guy named Neil Patel who's amazing. Gary Vaynerchuk is amazing. And Gary's just come into the music space, and especially into rap. He's really embraced rappers. And if you just follow his Instagram, you can really learn a lot of what you need to know. I mean, you need to go deeper than just one person. But there's so much information out here now, both for free and for a price, where you can sit in the comfort of your own home on your phone and learn, you know, just by going to websites.
Right.
So I would recommend that if you're somebody that doesn't want to do that and you really don't want to do the business side, then you're going to have to network and find somebody that not only you can trust, but who's good at the business side so that they can be that aspect of what your needs are. And then you're going to have to partner with them and you're going to have to give up a percentage of your income in order to hire them. You might even have to come out of pocket up front to get them to come on board, but you're going to have to figure out a way to accomplish that business side, because there is no artist that can make music in a void and not get it out there to the people. You got to get it out there to the people.
Right. And so when you're looking for that initial investor, or that one person to come in and help you out, how do you identify, you know, whether or not they're good for you? Like, I feel like a lot of artists sign bad deals and a lot of artists also get involved with the wrong people early on in their careers.
I agree.
What sorts of characteristics or qualities are you looking for in that initial person to say, okay, well, we can start out with this?
Well, the first thing that you need to have is an entertainment lawyer on your side, somebody that's done this before. Because you haven't gone down this road, it may be difficult to recognize the qualities that are in an investor. And sometimes artists get a little happy. They hear money and they don't look at anything else and they get very tunnel vision and they just jump on board with the first person that comes along. But the qualities that you want to look for is somebody that has been successful before, I don't know that I would want to have an investor that's never invested money in anything before and never been successful. That would worry me a little bit, mm-hmm. unless I had somebody like on board that has done this before, right. that could guide that investor. You know, a lot of times the investor is the one that brings me on board because they want to protect their money. And I think that's a good sign. Not necessarily somebody has to hire me. That's not the case, but somebody like me, somebody that's had success in the music business, recent success in the music business, and somebody that can get them to that next level. And if you just have money and you have nobody to guide you, you're going to blow through that money really quickly. Yeah. The investor may not get a return on their investment and you might fuck your shit up.
Right.
So you definitely want to look for someone that has some business experience and in a perfect world, some music business experience. You want somebody who's legitimate, somebody who's trustworthy and authentic. So do a Google search on your investor. And if a whole bunch of American Greed episodes pop up, don't do the deal.
Right.
So right. just somebody that's not a scam. And we have a lot of scam artists and con men and snakes in the music industry. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's an industry that just attracts those kind of folks. So you've got to make sure that you're getting into bed with somebody who's trustworthy and somebody that really has the money and is going to put it up for your career. And that's why at the very beginning, I prefaced it by saying, have a lawyer, because a great contract can really protect you. So for example, if you and I decide to go forward and you're the rapper and I'm the investor, wow, I'm going to make myself a bad guy. I hate that. Anyway, if I'm the investor and I agree to put in $150,000 into your career and we start moving forward and I only spend $20,000 and I get nervous and I don't want to put any more money in, you're not going to succeed. And then you're in a position where you're locked into this contract with me. It could be for 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. You could really be screwing yourself. So there's got to be some sort of a clause that says if you don't spend that, you know, whatever agreed upon amount of money is within X amount of months, then you get to leave with your masters so that you can go find somebody else and I don't end up holding you up because I'm a bad human being or something, you know?
Right. And a good entertainment attorney will be able to spot those things and be able
in a heartbeat,
you know, and will insert those things into any negotiation.
In a heartbeat, yes. There'll be different levels that somebody has to achieve. And this is true whether you're choosing a manager, whether you're choosing an investor, or whether you're choosing somebody like me. You want to make sure that they have to hit a certain goal set, and there has to be like an end date to the contract.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So we were talking about evil people and snakes in the music industry, right? And right now the popular narrative is that the record labels are the evil people or the evil entities, right? And obviously you've negotiated deals with major record labels for over 20 years now. So if they were all that bad, you know, just entirely, you wouldn't be doing what you do.
Exactly. And there was a time where I didn't. Like from 2005, I stopped doing deals in 2005 because the labels came up with this thing called a 360 deal. And I just felt like record deals were a little bit oppressive to begin with.
Yeah.
And then when they started doing 360 deals, which means they were taking a percentage of all income from all sources, I had such a problem with that that I wouldn't do deals. And I didn't start doing deals again until the year before last, because that's when the music industry started to become lucrative again, and the labels sort of chilled on the 360 deals.
Gotcha. So what was it about the 360 that, because I mean, we've heard Lior talk about the 360 and like, okay, well, we participate in all this and we put you out there. We deserve some of this, right? There's the argument that the manager is putting people in 360 deals technically. Why is it that you feel the 360 deal is and was so unfair for labels to ask for.
I felt it was unfair because they were taking revenue stream from an area where they didn't put in any work. So even though they were putting money into marketing and promoting the artist, they weren't going out and finding shows for the artist, but they were trying to take 30% of that income stream. Mm. And then the booking agent that would do the actual work was taking 10%. So the artist was now paying 40% of their show money in order to go do shows. Mm. And it became really expensive for artists to do, you know, to perform. So yeah. The fans weren't coming to the shows the way they are today, now that those 360 deals have either gone away or the split has become much lower. Like right now, when a major label takes a split of your show income, it's usually around 10%. I can live with 10% a little bit better than I can live with 30%. You know?
Yeah, definitely.
Now, when I say there's snakes and con men in the music industry, I don't mean major labels. Mm. I don't think Atlantic and Sony and Def Jam and Interscope are evil. I don't believe that they are. I think that as long as you're a priority at the label and as long as they market and promote you properly, it can be a really beneficial environment. Mm-hmm. Where it becomes a little bit of a gray area is when they have too many artists signed. I've seen labels go out and sign 20 artists. You mm-hmm. can't put out 20 artists in a year. You can't put out 20 artists in 5 years. Mm-hmm. So some of those artists are being signed to the label sort of a wait and see. And I think that's a really fucked up thing to do to somebody's career, is to just sign them and let them sit there and do nothing to help them, because you're forcing them to go out on their own and do it anyway. And then you're taking a percentage of money from them when you're not helping them get to the next level.
Right. Yeah. I mean, for example, I mean, a lot of the times the artists that I read about who were unhappy at their labels, right? Maybe Frank Ocean being the loudest of them, right? Big Crit is another that comes to mind, but that's what both of them complained about, you know, not being a priority. The label kind of letting them do whatever, and then all of a sudden they got popping and it was okay, now the label wants to kind of take over, and it felt aggressive to them.
Exactly. I think that also speaks to, and this is going to sound a little bit like I'm blaming the victim, and I'm not, but I think that as an artist, when you're starting to pop, and labels are coming to you, it's really important to choose the right partner as a label. I never thought that Crit was at the right label. I was very worried. As an insider, I saw the turmoil that the label was going through, and I was worried for him. You know, had he signed to Atlantic or Interscope, I think he would have been in a better situation. And as an artist, if you don't take the time to study the labels that you're about to sign to, like all deals are not the same. All record labels are not the same.
Right.
You know, Interscope happens to be great at pop. Atlantic is better at, they're great at pop too, but they're better at street, you know, with street artists. When you look at Def Jam right now, it's kind of like everybody's in a holding pattern. So why would you sign to Def Jam right now? They haven't really put out all of the artists that they've signed in the past 3 years. So how do you think you're going to come along and be the 37th artist? And I'm making up that number.
Right.
And folks at Def Jam are going to be really mad that I said that. But how are you going to come along and you're going to change everything at a label that's just not, the pipeline isn't moving. They're great at what they do. They have a great staff, but they're not moving through the pipeline at a speed that's going to be as conducive to your career as, you know, as somebody else in the Universal family. In my opinion, this is all my opinion.
Right.
And also you've got to, and not to say that the guys that weren't happy didn't do this, but when you take meetings with labels, you've got to meet everybody in the building. You want to meet the marketing people. You want to meet the radio guys. You want to meet the publicists. You want to meet the digital team. You've got to know what type of music are they good at promoting? You know, if you're signing to a label that's built on radio the way like Sony or even Atlantic are, and you're not an artist who makes radio records, why are you going there? You know, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for somebody that can be super commercial. And if you're trying to be super underground rapper, you're going to be really unhappy because you're going to keep turning in music and they're going to be looking for radio records.
Right.
And you're never going to come out because you're not delivering what they're great at or what they're looking for.
Yeah.
You know, you can't fit a square peg in a round hole. So when you sign a deal with a label, you can't just look at the money. You can't just look at the A&R guy. You've got to look at the whole overall picture.
Yeah.
You know, and most importantly, do you have access to the president of the label? You know, so that if shit goes wrong, can you get him on the phone or her on the phone? Can you get a meeting to sit down and say, look, how can we resolve this? What do I need to do to get this moving? And if we can't get it moving, then what can I do to get released so that I can go on and find something, you know, a situation where I can live my dreams?
Right. Yeah. And excuse me.
It's always easier to negotiate a deal when you've had success. So like for Drake to come in now and renegotiate his deal so that he can sign to his own label, to OVO, he's already seen the pitfalls. He already knows what the financials are. It just, and Taylor Swift, she's another great example. You know, you already know when you're renegotiating that you want to own as much of your publishing as you can, preferably 100%, and you want to buy your fucking masters back. So once you are in position to know what to look out for, it's so much easier than when you're brand new. And that's why you depend on somebody with experience and an entertainment lawyer to help you, because people like myself and entertainment lawyers who've done a lot of deals, we know what to look out for. We know how it could go wrong, and we know what to put in the contract to protect an artist so that it doesn't go left. If you're sitting still for 6 to 9 months, there should be a clause in your contract that you're allowed to get the fuck and you take your masters with you.
Right. Yeah. So while we've brought up Taylor Swift, do you have thoughts on this whole situation between Taylor Swift and Big Machine and Scooter Braun? Well, I guess I'll recap for a second. So Taylor Swift was signed to Big Machine Records, which was an indie label based in Nashville. And that's who she'd been with from her first album up until basically now. She hasn't come out with her new album yet, has she?
Yes, she has.
Oh, she did. Okay.
She did on Universal. Yes.
Got you. So
I want to say it was like 6 albums, but don't quote me on that because I didn't really follow her career.
Got you. Yeah.
I'm a rap person. Like if it's not rap,
Right. And see, my intro to Taylor was the VMAs, and I never really followed her after that either. But to make the long story short, she left Big Machine, went to Universal, like you said. And, you know, apparently she was trying to negotiate a deal where she could get her masters back, eventually decided it wasn't worth the trouble and went to Universal. Then the label gets sold to Scooter Braun, who's probably most famous for being Justin Bieber's manager.
And Ariana Grande.
Ariana Grande and Psy and Kanye at one point.
And Kanye, still sort of kind of Kanye, I think. Who knows?
I don't. You never know with that guy.
That's another podcast episode.
Right. And so, but you know, so Taylor took offense to the label being sold to Scooter Braun, because she's like, well, Scooter's been bullying me, whatever validity that may have. And so, but I guess the point I was making was when it came down to this conversation, the story was pointed in the media as if Taylor was the victim. And it's like, well, most artists that sign to a label, one, don't own their masters, two, don't necessarily get a chance to buy them back, and absolutely can't control who those things get sold to. So it's like, well, how is this argument valid just because you don't like the person it got sold to?
Right. It's emotional, really. I felt no empathy for her whatsoever. And here's why. I mean, I feel bad that she felt bad. So yeah. I'm not taking away from her pain. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying she shouldn't have felt that. I'm saying she should have bought the fucking company. If she didn't want Scooter to own her masters, she's in the same or better position that he was in to put together investors to come in and buy Big Machine. Why didn't she do that? So I have no sympathy. I have no empathy for her. If buying the masters back was that important to her, and it should have been, then she would have made it happen by any means necessary. Yeah. You know, whether that meant if she tried to negotiate them with Universal when she did her deal and she couldn't get them back. And when you hear Big Machine's side of it, they came out and said that they gave her the opportunity to buy back her masters, and she didn't. You know, her own father was her manager, right? Or right. is her manager. And if I remember correctly, he owns 12% of Big Machine.
Right. He was an investor.
Which, of course, is a conflict of interest. Welcome to the music business. You're fucked. But if he was on the inside of the company, he had to know that Scooter Braun was buying the company. And one of the things that Scott Borchetta said publicly was, I sent you text messages. Here are copies of them of me telling you that I was going to sell to Scooter, and you didn't respond. So
yeah,
it's just really hard to take her side, but because she is an artist and she's very, very, very smart, you know, I mean, she's incredibly intelligent. So for her to play the emotion card, it just, you know, for me, it was like a publicity move. Like I saw her get a whole lot of attention this summer from that. And, you know, bless her for doing that. I don't know that she did it just for that. It may have been very real, but, you know, why couldn't she put together hedge funds and buy back her company, you know, buy back her masters or buy Big Machine?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's a
fuck of a lot more famous than he is.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a bank in the world that wouldn't put those funds together.
Hello. Like,
Taylor Swift. Yeah. Let's do it.
Shit. She could have done a GoFundMe campaign and done it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'm being funny, but she's Taylor Swift.
Right.
She could have gone on her Instagram and said, I'm looking for investors to help me buy back my masters, or I'm looking for investors to help me buy Big Machine, which, by the way, is a really good investment. Mm-hmm. And every news media in this world would have picked that up, and people would have flocked to her trying to give her money.
Right. Yeah, that's
it's
weird.
It's hard to feel bad.
It is. I don't know. I mean, from my perspective, like I said, being a very casual listener, it just seems like it's the same story every couple of years with Taylor. Like, there is some person that's the bad guy and she's the victim. And now you guys should buy my music to help me feel better.
It works.
It does work.
It works for her. It works for her. She sells a lot of music. You know, she's got fans that are rabid, that defend her, you know?
That's interesting. But I mean, that's the power of a fan base.
Yes.
So as we kind of want,
kudos to Scooter for not suing her for slander, because he probably could have.
Right.
Yeah. So kudos to him for, and I don't know either of them, so I don't mean to sound like I'm taking sides.
Right. Got you. So as we wind down, you mentioned earlier that you're probably most famous or most well known for helping with the Cash Money deal.
Yep.
And that's how I know who you were. I started studying the music industry back in 2010, 2011. And back then, there were a few books you could buy. You could get All You Need to Know About the Music Business. You could get, I had the music. Yeah, Donald Passman. I had Mike King's books, like basically anything from Berkeley Press. And then there was How to Get a Record Deal by Wendy Day. And I was like, oh, this is cool. And so, but you know, so I type in Wendy Day, and that's basically everything that came up. And so I guess with that being your claim to fame, what lessons did you take away from that negotiation process and that experience?
The biggest, they're too big. There were two big, what a great question. Nobody's ever asked me this. There are two big things that I took away from that. The biggest was leverage is king. That was the biggest lesson. The more leverage you have, the better the deal can be. And then the second lesson that I took away from that was the reason that deal was so amazing is because Slim and Baby let me say no to the offers that came in for 9 months. They didn't jump at the first offer. The first offer was from Penalty Records for $75,000 just for Juvenile. That was in August of 97. In March of 98, these guys got a $30 million deal. Just to show you the difference between $75,000 up front and $30 million. I think it was $2 or $3 million up front, and then, you know, a line of credit for everything that they did. And it was an 80-20 split, as opposed to Penalty. I think it was either 12% or 15% of, you know, the royalty rate after they recouped everything. So I learned that as long as the client trusts me and lets me do what I do, we can win. Yeah. And I have clients now today where I'm helping build their label, and they see my success, they see my recent success, and they still say shit to me like, okay, I hear you telling me that I should do this, but I want to go over here and do that. And then it becomes a big mess, and then I have to clean up the mess.
Right.
You know, and it demotivates me. It's really hard to do shit just to please a client when I know that it's probably not going to work, and it's just going to lead to more work for me.
Yeah.
You know, and I've got a couple clients like that who just, you know, they argue with me when I say, oh, we should do this. And it's like, eh, I don't want to do that. But it works.
Right. Right. It's like, you hired me as a consultant for a reason.
Exactly.
You know, so I want to just pause for a second and just go back to those numbers, because I don't think there's been a deal signed like that since. So just to make sure people...
Well, the industry changed a lot. Like, don't forget, that was 1998 at the height of CD sales.
Right. Yeah.
It's a different world today.
Yeah. But I just, when I think about just, because I mean, you hear all the time about people just signing these terrible deals and being slaves and so on and so forth, right? To get an 80-20 split. And I guess it's true. Like, I mean, you had a CD, you could print money at the time, you know, but to get an 80-20 split with that kind of line of credit, and for them to be able to carry that on even through now, right? Tells you a lot about them.
Yes.
Like, there were smart people in that room.
Extremely. And, you know, it's a little unfortunate. Well, it's a blessing and a curse. When, after I did their deal, they didn't pay me, and I had to sue them to get paid for doing the deal. And they paid me, and, you know, happy ending, right? But my point in telling you that is I was suing them 20 months in to the project. And when I went in and did the accounting, like looked at the financials and saw how much money they were making, they were even more profitable than we had projected. So Universal was happy, Cash Money was happy, like it just really worked. It was really an amazing deal. And then look at how long they lasted. You know, up until then, most of the smaller labels that were signed by majors would have like maybe a 5-year run or so. And their run was like incredible. And then it turned from Cash Money into Young Money. Like it really just grew and grew and grew and became something really super special. I'm proud of them.
I would say so too.
Yeah.
What is it about Cash Money and not?
I'm sorry about my dog barking in the background.
It's okay.
The landscapers are here and he's tripping.
So, and not to badmouth anyone, but we hear these stories in the press about Cash Money not paying people. Do you think it's just like accounting errors? Do you think it's really malicious? Like what?
I don't know the answer to that. I stopped working with them in 1998. So my knowledge of them is 20 some odd years old. So
yeah.
It's very hard for me to say what their mind state is today compared to back then.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that.
Gotcha. So as we wrap up, this has been an amazing conversation. I think we've talked through all different aspects of an artist's journey, whether they're just starting out, whether they decide they want to stay independent, or if they want to go to a label, what they should look out for. But is there any parting advice or wisdom you want to leave with the audience?
Absolutely. You know, just like you wouldn't step onto a basketball court if you're in the NBA without knowing how to play the game, who all the other opposition players are, the rules of the game, you know, the history of the game. Why would the music industry be any different? You know, as you're growing your career, obviously focus on the music and get as great as you can with the music, but please study the industry. Learn how this works, because nobody can take advantage of you if you understand the rules of the game. You kind of learn the rules you can break, the rules you can push, and you learn the ones that you can't. But learn them. Learn how this works, because then no one can take advantage of you. And there is a lot of information out there today to educate you about the music business, and most of it is free.
Yeah.
So read as much as you can. There's a lot of bullshit out there too, mind you. But study as much as you can. You know, I've got a YouTube channel with free videos. Don't just study me. Study a lot of other people. You know, watch DJ Payne One. Watch Brandman Sean. You know, watch podcasts like yours. And by the way, I got to give you so much love for doing this, because you're not making money doing this, and I know that. I know that this is a labor of love for you, and you could be doing anything else right now, but you're choosing to do this, and I love you for that. And I will always support you for this.
Thank you.
But folks have to, like, they have to watch your vlogs and listen to your podcasts and read as many books. You know, there's a great book. You mentioned all the books. I want to add in The Big Payback by Dan Charnas. It's the history of the financial side of hip hop. It's an amazing book. And if you learn the history and you learn where this came from and you learn the types of deals people have done in the past when they had leverage, then you will learn what to ask for today as you're doing deals.
Absolutely.
So learn the business. That would be, you know, the most important advice. And I've already harped on having a great entertainment lawyer. So I'll harp on that one more time.
Right.
I have a really great entertainment lawyer. I'm 27 years into this. I do amazing deals, and I still have entertainment attorneys with me every step of the way when I'm negotiating. They are right there next to me. They are right there next to me.
Absolutely.
And if I'm doing that, and I've done this, I've done 15 to 20 deals. If you're on your first deal, why would you not follow that advice? Success leaves clues.
That's a bar.
Success leaves clues. I bang my head so that you don't have to.
Yeah. Hove did that, so hopefully you don't have to go through that. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time, and thanks for doing this. And keep it up. This is awesome.
Thank you. So for anyone who wants to stay in touch with you or keep up with your content and everything, how do they keep up with you?
They can go to wendyday.com. Okay. That is sort of the one site that links to everything. It links to my podcast, my books, my videos. It kind of links to everything. If somebody needs to reach out to me, I'm really very accessible. My email address is under every single one of my videos on my YouTube channel, or they can reach me at thisiswendyday@gmail.com, or they can talk to me on Instagram. Instagram is kind of my platform of choice. We all kind of have one aspect of social media that we pay attention to the most. For me, it's Instagram. I like pictures and videos. So you can go to @rapcoalition and you can leave a comment. Don't DM me. I will never check my DMs. Don't call me. I will never call you back. I'm being honest.
Yeah.
But if you email me, you will be surprised at how fast you get a response.
Yeah, I mean, we set this up very quickly. So
I respond to all my emails. It's if you reach me the way that I'm comfortable being reached, I'm easy peasy. But if you try to reach out to me in a format that, like, I can't be on the phone all day. I've got clients who pay me to work for them. I can't be on the phone and doing my work, but right. I can work and have my email up and answer very quickly.
Gotcha. Well, I will leave your contact information in the description of this video and in awesome. The podcast show notes as well.
Awesome.
Well, thank you again for your time, Wendy. This was
thank
great.
Thank you.
No problem.
I love that you do this. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. And that is going to do it for today's episode of Music Business Dreams. I hope you guys listened and took notes. We talked offline for a little bit longer after this in a conversation that was exclusive to our community members in the Indie Club, as well as in my private coaching classes. So if you have not joined the Indie Club, I keep telling you, you got to do it. You know, I've been taking a break from the podcast, but I have not taken a break from the Indie Club. We're still going strong every day. So facebook.com/, that's not it. It's kdmr.us/IndieClub. I'll leave the link in the show notes. But join the Indie Club. You get exclusive content. You get Q&A sessions. You get to network with a group of over 300 music industry professionals and artists to take your career to the next level. So I'm excited to have you there. By the way, this episode, for the first time, is being streamed on YouTube. I've got a full video interview on YouTube, and there are some clips that'll be coming out later on in the week. So if you go ahead and subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/KDMR Music, you'll be able to get access to that as well. So until next time, in a couple of weeks, right now we're going through a move. That is why the podcast had to just stop for a second. So I am moving. I move into my new place on October 23rd. We will have a brand new episode of Music Business Dreams. What's that Wednesday? October 30th. So new episode on the 30th of October. And I'll see you then. Peace.